Welcome to this Uvula audio production of Aunts Are Not Gentlemen by P.G. Wodehouse. Volume 4, Chapter 13.
One of the questions put to me when I won that Scripture Knowledge Prize at my private school was, I recall, what do you know of the deaf adder? And my grip on Holy Writ enabled me to reply correctly that it stopped its ears and would not hear the voice of the charmer. Charm he never so wisely. And after my session with Herbert Graham, I knew how that charmer must have felt. If I had been in a position to compare notes with him, we would have agreed that the less we saw of adders in the future, the better it would be for us. Nobody could have charmed more wisely than me as I urged Herbert Graham to lower his price, and nobody could have stopped his ears more firmly than did that human serpent. Talk about someone not meeting you halfway. He didn't go an inch in the direction of coming to a peaceful settlement. 35 quid, I mean to say. That's monstrous. But that's what happens when you're up against it, and the other fellow holds all the cards. Haggling is a thing that takes it out of you, and it was a limp Bertram Wooster who, after Graham and the cat had set forth on their journey, sat skimming listlessly through the opening pages of By Order of the Tsar. And I had read enough to make me wish I had taken out The Mystery of the Hansom Cab instead, when the telephone rang. It was, as I had feared, Aunt Dahlia. Sooner or later I had, of course, realized exchanges with the aged relative were inevitable. But I could have faced them better if they could have been postponed for a while. In my enfeebled condition I was in no shape to cope with aunts. A man who has just become engaged to a girl, whose whole personality gives him a sinking feeling, and who has had to pay 35 quid to a bloodsucker, and another 2 pence to a lending library for a dud book, is seldom in mid-season form. The old ancestor, on the other hand, little knowing that she was about to get a sock on the jaw which would shake her to her very foundation garments, was all light-heartedness and joviality.
"Hello, you fathead! What news on the Rialto?"
"What? Where?" I responded, not getting it.
"The cat, has he brought it?"
"Yes."
"Is it in your bosom?"
I saw the time had come, shrink though I might from revealing the awful truth, it had to be done. I took a deep breath. It was some small comfort to feel she was at the end of a telephone wire 1.5 miles away. You can never be certain what aunts will do when at close quarters. Far less provocation in my earlier days had led this one to buffet me soundly on the side of the head. "No," I said, "it's gone."
"Gone? Gone where?"
"Billy Graham has taken it back."
"Taken it back?"
"To Haggisford Court. I told him to."
"You told him to?"
"Yes, you see..." And that concluded for a considerable space of time my share in the duologue, for she got into high with the promptness which I had anticipated, and spoke as follows.
"Hell's bells, ye gods, angels and ministers of grace, defend us! He brought the cat, and you deliberately turned it from your door, though you knew what it meant to me. You let the side down. You failed me in my hour of need. You bring grey hairs and sorrow to the grave. And after all I've done for you, you miserable, ungrateful worm, do you remember me telling you that when you were a babe and suckling and looking at my ad in passing, like a badly poached egg, you nearly swallowed your rubber comforter? And if I hadn't jerked it out in time, you would have choked to death. It would go hard for you if you swallowed your rubber comforter now. I wouldn't stir a finger. Do you remember when you had measles, and I gave up hours of my valuable time to play tiddlywinks with you, and letting you beat me without a murmur?"
I could have disputed this. My victories had been due entirely to my skill. I haven't played much tiddlywinks lately, but in those boyhood days I was pretty hot stuff at the pastime. I didn't mention this, however, because she was now proceeding, and I didn't like to interrupt the flow.
"Do you remember when you were at that private school of yours? I used to send you parcels of food at enormous expense, because you said you were about to expire from starvation. Do you remember when you were at Oxford?"
"Stop, Aged R," I cried, for she had touched me deeply with these reminiscences of the young Wooster. "You're breaking my heart."
"You haven't got a heart. If you had, you wouldn't have driven that poor defenceless cat out into the snow. All I asked of you was to give it a bed in the spare room for a few days, and so place my financial affairs on a sound basis, but you wouldn't do a trifling service for me,
which would have cost you nothing except a bob or two for milk and fish. What, I ask myself, has become of the old-fashioned nephew to whom his aunt's wishes were law? They don't seem to be making them nowadays.
At this point, nature took its toll. She had to pause to take in a breath, and I was unable to speak. Old blood relation, you're under a what is it?
What is what?
The thing people get under, it's on the tip of my tongue, begins with miss. Ah, I've got it. Misapprehension. I've heard Jeeves use the word. Your view of my behavior with the above cat is all cockeyed. I disapproved of your pinching it because I felt that such an action stained the escutcheon of the Worcesters. But I would have given it bed and board however reluctantly had it not been for Plank.
Plank?
Major Plank, the explorer.
What does he have to do with this?
Everything. You've probably heard of Major Plank.
No, I have not.
Well, he's one of those chaps who have native bearers and things and go exploring. Who was it out in Africa somewhere who met the other fellow and presumed that he was Doctor something? Plank is or was in the same line of business. A snort came over the wire, nearly fusing it.
Bertie!
Said the blood relation, now having taken aboard an adequate supply of oxygen.
I am hampered by being at the other end of the telephone, but were I within reach of you, I would give you one on the side of the head which you wouldn't forget in a hurry. Tell me in a few simple words what you think you're talking about.
I'm talking about Plank, and what I'm trying to establish is that Plank, though an explorer, is not exploring now. He's staying with Cook at Eggersford Court.
So what?
So jolly well this. He dropped in on me shortly after Billy Graham had clocked in and left the cat. It was with Jeeves in the kitchen, having one for the tonsils. And while Plank was in there, it yowled. And Plank, of course, heard it. You don't need to be told the upshot. Plank goes back to Cook, tells him what he thought he heard was a cat at Worcester's address. And Cook, already suspicious of me after our unfortunate encounter, comes down here like a wolf on the fold, his cohorts all gleaming with purple and gold. I ought to add that I told Plank that the cat he heard was not a cat at all, but Jeeves imitating cats. And he believed it all right, because explorers are simple-minded bozos who believe everything they're told. But will the story get over with Cook? Not a hope. There was nothing for me to do but tell Billy Graham to return the cat. I suppose one of the top-notch barristers could have put it more clearly, but not much more. She was silent for a space, musing, no doubt, and weighing this against that. Finally she spoke.
I see.
Good.
You appear not to have been such a non-cooperative hellhound as I thought you were.
Excellent.
Sorry I ticked you off with such vigour.
Quite all right, aged relative. Tu comprends, c'est tout pardon.
Yes, I suppose it was the only thing you could do. But don't expect any hallelujahs from me. My whole plan of campaign has gone foot.
Oh, I don't know. Perhaps everything will be all right. Similar may win anyway.
Yes, but one did like to feel that one was betting on a certainty. It's no good trying to cheer me up. I feel awful.
Me too.
What's wrong with you?
I'm engaged to be married to a woman I can't stand the sight of.
Another one? Who is it this time?
Vanessa Cook.
Any relation to old Cook?
His daughter.
How did this happen?
I proposed to her a year ago, and she turned me down. And just now she blew in and said she had changed her mind and would marry me. It came as a nasty shock.
You should have told her to go and boil her head.
I couldn't.
Why couldn't you?
It's not pro.
Not what?
Pro. P for potted meat, R for rissole, E for eggnog, and so on. You've heard of a pro chevalier? It is my aim to be one.
Oh, well, if you go about being pro, you must expect to get into trouble. But I wouldn't worry. You're bound to wriggle out of it somehow. You told me once you had faith in your star. The girls you've been engaged to and have escaped from would reach, if placed end to end, from Piccadilly to Hyde Park. I won't believe you're married till I see the bishop and assistant clergy mopping their foreheads and saying, "Well, that's that. We've really got the young blighter off at last."
And with these words of cheer, she rang off. You would have rather expected that it would have been with a light heart I returned to by order of the Tsar. Such, however, was not the case.
I had squared myself with the old flesh and blood, and so had put a stopper on her wrath, a continuance of which might have resulted in her barring me from her table for an indefinite period, thus depriving me of the masterpieces of her French chef, Anatole, God's gift to the gastric juices. But, as I say, the H was not L. I could not mourn but for the collapse of the aged relative's hopes and dreams, a collapse for which I, though a mere toy in the hands of fate, was bound to consider myself responsible. I said as much to Jeeves when he came in with the materials for the pre-dinner cocktail. "My heart is heavy, Jeeves," I said, after expressing gratification at the sight of the fixings.
"Indeed, sir. Why is that?"
"I've just been having a painful scene with Aunt Dahlia. Well, when I say scene, that's not quite the right word, the conversation having been conducted over the telephone. Did Graham get off all right?"
"Yes, sir."
"Accompanied by Cat?"
"Yes, sir."
"That's what I was telling her, and she became a bit emotional. You never hunted with the corn or Pitchley, did you, Jeeves? It seems to do something to the vocabulary. Lends the speaker eloquence. The old flesh and blood didn't have to pause to pick her words. They came out like bullets from a machine gun. I was thankful we weren't talking face to face. Goodness knows what might have happened if we had been."
"You should have told Mrs. Travers the facts relating to Major Plank, sir."
"I did. The moment I could get a word in edgewise. And it was like that acted like..."
"Like what?" "Balm in Gilead, sir."
"Exactly. I was going to say manna in the wilderness, but balm in Gilead hits it off better. She calmed down and admitted I couldn't have done anything else but return the cat."
"Most satisfactory, sir."
"Yes, that part of it is all pretty smooth. But there's one other thing that's weighing on me a bit. I'm engaged to be married."
Chapter 14.
As always, when I tell him I'm engaged to be married, he betrayed no emotion, continuing to look as if he had been stuffed by a good taxidermist. It is not his place, he would say, if you asked him, to go beyond the basic formalities on these occasions.
"Indeed, sir."
"Usually this about covers it, and I don't discuss my predicament with him. I feel it wouldn't be seemly, if that's the word. And I know he would feel it wouldn't be seemly. So, with both of us feeling it wouldn't be seemly, we talk of other matters. But this was a special occasion. Never before had I become betrothed to someone who would make me cut out smoking and cocktails, and in my opinion, this made the subject a legitimate one for debate. When you're up against it as I was, it's essential to exchange views with a mastermind, if you can get hold of one, however unseemly it may be. So when he added, 'May I offer my congratulations?' I replied with lines which were not in the routine. 'No, Jeeves, you may not by a jugful. You see before you a man who is near to being what is known as a toad at Harrow, as a man can be who is educated at Eton. I'm in sore straits, Jeeves.'
'I'm sorry to hear that, sir.'
'You'll be sorrier when I explain further. Have you ever seen a garrison besieged by howling savages, with their ammunition down to the last box of cartridges, the water supply giving out, and the United States Marines nowhere to be seen?'
'Not to my recollection, sir.'
'Well, my position is roughly that of such a garrison, except that compared with me, they're sitting pretty. Compared with me, they haven't a thing to worry about.'
'You fill me with alarm, sir.'
'I bet I do, and I haven't even started yet. I'll begin by saying that Miss Cook, to whom I'm engaged, is a lady for whom I have the utmost esteem and respect. But on certain matters we do not... what's the expression?
See eye to eye, sir.'
'That's right, and unfortunately those matters are the... what do you call it of my whole policy? What is it that policies have?'
'I think the word for which you are groping, sir, may possibly be cornerstone.'
'Thank you, Jeeves. She disapproves of a variety of things which are at the cornerstone of my policy. Marriage with her must inevitably mean that I shall have to cast them from my life, for she has a will of iron, and will have no difficulty in making her husband jump through hoops and snap sugar off his nose. You get what I mean?'
'I do, sir. A very colourful image.'
'Cocktails, for instance, will be barred. She says they're bad for the liver. Have you noticed, by the way, how frightfully lax everything's getting now? In Queen Victoria's day, a girl would never have dreamed of mentioning livers in mixed company.'
Very true, sir. Tempora mutanta,
Nos et mutamar in illis.
That, however, is not the worst.
You horrify me, sir.
At a pinch, I could do without cocktails. It would be agony, but we Worcesters can rough it. But she says I must give up smoking.
This was indeed the most unkindest cut of all, sir.
Give up smoking, Jeeves!
Yes, sir. You will notice I am shuddering.
The trouble is that she is greatly under the influence of a pal of hers called Tolstoy. Never met him, but he seems to have the most extraordinary ideas. You won't believe this, Jeeves, but he says that no one needs to smoke, as equal pleasure can be obtained by twirling the fingers. The man is an ass! Imagine a posh public dinner, one of those decorations will be worn things. The royal toast has been drunk, strong men are licking their lips at the thought of cigars, and the toastmaster bellows, "Gentlemen, you may twirl your fingers." Don't tell me there wouldn't be a flat feeling, a sense of disappointment. Do you know anything about this fellow Tolstoy, Jeeves? Ever heard of him?
Oh, yes, sir. He is a famous Russian novelist.
Russian, eh? Well, there you are, and a novelist. He didn't write by order of the Tsar, did he?
I believe not, sir.
I thought he might have, under another name. You say was. Is he no longer with us?
No, sir. He died some years ago.
Well, good for him. Twirl your fingers. Too absurd. I'd laugh, only she says I mustn't laugh because another pal of hers, called Chesterfield, didn't. Well, she didn't worry. The way things are shaping, I haven't anything to laugh about. For I've not mentioned the principal objection to the marriage. Don't jump to the hasty conclusion that I mean because a father-in-law like Cook is included in the package deal. I grant you, that's enough by itself to darken the horizon. But what's on my mind is the thought of all old Porter.
Ah, yes, sir.
I gave him an austere look. If you can't say anything better than, ah, yes, Jeeves, say nothing.
Very good, sir.
The thought, as I was saying, of old Porter. We have already touched on his testy disposition, the iron band-like muscles of his brawny arms and his jealousy, the mere suspicion that I was inflicting my beastly society, as he put it, on Miss Cook was enough to make him tell me he would tear my insides out with his bare hands. What'll he do when he finds out I'm engaged to her?
Surely, sir, the lady having so unequivocally rejected him, he can scarcely blame you.
For filling the vacant spot? Don't believe it. I take it for granted I persuaded her to give him the pink slip. Nothing will drive out of his nut the belief that I'm a grade-A snake in the grass. And we all know what to expect from snakes in the G. No, we have got to be frightfully subtle and think of some plan for drawing his fangs. Otherwise my insides won't be worth a moment's purchase. I was about to go on and ask him if he still had that cosh, or blackjack, as the American term is, which he had taken away from Aunt Dahlia's son, Bonzo, some months previously. Bonzo had bought it to use on a schoolmate he disliked, and we all thought he would be better without it. It was, of course, precisely what I needed to ease the tenseness of the O. Porter situation. Armed with this weapon, I could defy O. Porter without a qualm. Before I could speak, the telephone tootled in the hall, and I waved a hand in this direction. Answer that, would you mind, Jeeves, and say I've gone for a brisk walk, as recommended by my medical adviser. That'll be Aunt Dahlia, and though she was in a reasonable frame of mind at the conclusion of our recent talk, there's no telling how long these reasonable frames of mind last.
Very good, sir.
You know what women are?
I do indeed, sir.
Especially aunts.
Yes, sir, my aunt.
Tell me about her later, Jeeves.
Any time you wish, sir.
I remember Jeeves once saying of my friend Catsmeet Potter Pierbright. It was when a long shot he had backed had come in first by a head, only to be disqualified, owing to some infringement of the rules by its jockey, that melancholy had marked him for her own. And it was the same with me now, as I sat totting up the score and realizing how extraordinarily deeply I'd been plunged in the soup. Compared with other items on the list of my troubles, it was perhaps a minor cause for melancholy that the old ancestor should be trying to get me on the telephone. Nonetheless, it added one more thing to worry about. It could only mean, I felt, that she had come out of the amiable mood she'd been in when last heard from, and had thought of a lot more nasty cracks to make on the subject of my failure to reach the standard which she considered adequate in a nephew. I was in no shape to listen to destructive criticism when next we met, especially when delivered by a voice trained by years of shouting,
gone away at Fox's to reduce the hero's nervous system to pulp. When, therefore, Jeeves returned, my first observation was, what did she say?
It was not Mrs. Travers, sir. It was Mr. Porter.
I was more thankful than ever that I had got him to answer the phone. What did he say, I asked, though I could have made a rough guess.
I regret that I am not able to report the entire conversation verbatim, sir. I found the gentleman incoherent at the outset. I gathered that he was under the impression that he was addressing you, and emotion interfered with the clarity of his diction. I informed him of my identity, and he moderated his verbal speed. I was thus enabled to follow him, and he gave me several messages to give to you.
Messages?
Yes, sir. Embodying what he proposed to do to you when next you met. His remarks were in the main of a crudely surgical nature, and many of the plans he outlined would be extremely difficult to put into practice. His threat, for example, to pull off your head and make you swallow it.
He said that?
Among other things, more or less of the same trend, sir, but you need have no apprehension.
It shows the state to which the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, as somebody called them, had reduced me, that I didn't laugh a hacking laugh at this. I didn't even utter a sardonic, oh yeah, or says you. I merely buried the face in the hands, and he continued.
Before I left the room, you were speaking of the necessity of drawing Mr. Porter's fangs, as you most aptly put it. It gives me a great pleasure to say I have succeeded in doing this.
I thought I couldn't have heard him correctly, and asked him to repeat this amazing statement. He did so, and I looked at him astounded. You might suppose I would have been used to it by now, seeing him pull rabbits out of a hat with a flick of a wrist, and solve in a flash problems which had defied the best efforts of the finest minds. But it always comes fresh to me, depriving me of breath and causing the eyeballs to rotate in the parent sockets. Then I saw what must be behind the easy confidence with which he had spoken. So, you remember the cosh I said?
Sir.
And you have it in your possession?
I do not quite understand you, sir.
I thought you meant you still had that cosh, which you took away from Aunt Dahlia's Monzo, and were going to give it to me, so I'd be armed when Porter made his spring.
Oh, no, sir. The instrument to which you refer is among my effects at our London residence.
Then how did you draw his fangs?
By reminding him that you have taken out an accident policy with him, and drawing his attention to the inevitable displeasure of his employers if through him they were mulcted out of a substantial sum of money. I had little difficulty in persuading the gentleman that anything in the nature of aggressive action on his part would be a mistake.
I repeated the stare. His resource and ingenuity stunned me. Jeeves, your resource and ingenuity stun me. Porter is baffled.
Yes, sir.
Unless you would prefer thwarted.
Baffled, I think, is stronger, sir.
Talk of drawing his fangs. His dentist will have to fit him with a completely new set.
Yes, sir, but we must not forget that the removal of Mr. Porter as a menace is only half your battle. I hesitate to touch on a delicate subject.
Touch on, Jeeves.
But I gathered partly from what you were saying, and partly from the tone of your voice as you said it when you were speaking of her plans for the future, that the idea of marriage with Miss Cook is not wholly agreeable to you, and it occurred to me that much unpleasantness would be avoided were the lady and Mr. Porter to be reconciled.
It would indeed, but—
You were about to say, sir, that in your opinion the rift is too serious for that.
Well, isn't it?
I think not, sir.
Your blow-by-blow description of the hostilities certainly gave me the impression that they had parted brass rags pretty finely. How about that lily-livered poltroon?
You have placed your fingers on the real trouble, sir. Miss Cook applied that term to Mr. Porter because of his refusal to approach her father and demand the money which the latter is holding in trust for him.
Well, according to you, he said he wouldn't approach her father in a million years.
The situation has been changed by your becoming affianced to the woman he loves. To restore himself to Miss Cook's esteem, he would face perils from which formerly he shrank.
I got what he meant, but I didn't buy the idea. I still saw Orlo shrinking.
Furthermore, sir, if you were to go to Mr. Porter and point out to him that success might crown his efforts, if he were to choose a moment shortly after dinner to approach Mr. Cook. He would take the risk.
A gentleman mellowed by a good dinner is always more amenable to overtures of any kind than one who is waiting for his food. As I understood from his conversation that Mr. Cook was when Mr. Porter discussed business with him on a former occasion.
I started visibly. He had electrified me. Jeeves, I believe you've got something.
I think so, sir.
I'll go and see Porter at once. He's probably at the Goose and Grasshopper, drowning his sorrows in gin and ginger ale. And let me say once more, you stand alone, sir. You have made my day. I wish there was something I could do for you by way of return.
There is, sir.
It's yours, even unto half my kingdom. Give me a name.
I should be extremely grateful if you would allow me to spend the night at my aunt's.
You want to go to Liverpool? That's a long journey.
No, sir. My aunt returned this morning and is at her home in the village.
Then go to her, Jeeves, and heaven smile upon your reunion.
Thank you very much, sir. Should you have need of my services, the address is Balmoral, Mafeking Road, care of Mrs. P.B. Piggott.
Oh, she's out of Jeeves.
No, sir.
He shimmered out to return a moment later with information that Mr. Graham was in the kitchen and would be glad of a word with me. And it shows the extent to which the strain and rush of life at Maiden Eggersford had taken its toll that for the moment the name conveyed nothing to me. Then memory returned to its throne, and I felt as anxious to see Mr. Graham as he apparently was to see me. Such was my confidence in him as a returner of cats, I could not imagine him failing in his mission. But I was naturally anxious to have the full details. In the kitchen, you say?
Yes, sir.
Then bung him in, Jeeves. There is no one I'd rather give audience to at the moment. And the hour, which was getting on for 6 o'clock, produced the man. I was struck, as before, by the intense respectability of his appearance. He looked as though no rabbit or pheasant need entertain the slightest tremor in his presence, and one could readily picture him as the backbone of the choir when anthem time came along. His gentle good evening, sir, was a treat to listen to. Good evening, I said in return. Well, did you accomplish a mission? A cat back at the old stand? His eyes darkened, as if I had brought to the surface a secret sorrow.
Well, yes and no, sir.
What do you mean, yes and no?
To the first of your questions, the answer is in the affirmative. I did accomplish my mission, but unfortunately, the cat is not at the old stand.
I don't get you.
It is here, sir, in your kitchen. I took it to Eggersford Court, as per our contract, and released it near the stables, and started on my homeward journey, happy to have earned the money which you so generously paid me for my services. Picture my astonishment and dismay when, on reaching the village, I discovered the cat had followed me. It's a very affectionate animal, sir, and we have become great friends. Would you wish me to take it back again? Of course I should not feel justified in charging my full fee. So, shall we say £10?
If you want to know how this proposition affected me, I can put it in a nutshell by saying I'd read him like a book. Many people are led by my frank and open countenance into thinking that I am one of the mugs, but I know a twister when I see one, and I was in no doubt that one of these stood before me now. What stopped me drawing myself to my full height and denouncing him was the reflection that the blighter had left me in a cleft stick. Refusal to come across would mean him going to Pop Cook and getting a handsome fee from him for revealing that the aged relative had paid him to purloin the cat, and in spite of what she had said about her popularity in Maiden Eggersford, resulting from her rendering Every Nice Girl Loves a Sailor in a sailor suit, I knew that her name would be Mud. I still wasn't sure she couldn't even be jugged, and what a sock in the eye that would give Uncle Tom's digestion. I dispersed the tenor, not blithely, but I dispersed it, and he went on his way. For some time after he had left, I sat wrapped in thought, and then just as I was getting up to go and see Orlo, in came Vanessa Cook.
Chapter 15.
She was accompanied by a dog about the size of a young elephant, yellow in colour, with large ears sticking up, with whom I would willingly have fraternized, but after drinking in the delicious scent of my trouser legs for a brief moment, it saw something out in the street which aroused its interest and left us. Vanessa, meanwhile, had picked up my By the Order of the Tsar,
and I could see by the way she sniffed that she was about to become critical. There had always been a strong strain of book review of blood in her.
"Trash,"
she said.
"Harold, it really is time you began reading something worthwhile. I don't expect you to start off with Turgenev and Dostoevsky,"
she said, evidently alluding to a couple of Russian exiles she'd met in London who did a bit of writing on the side.
"But there are plenty of good books which are easier and at the same time educational. I have brought one with me."
She went on, and I saw that she was holding a slim volume, bound in limp purple leather, with some sort of decoration in gold on the cover. I shuddered strongly. To a man who has seen as much of life as I have, there is always something sinister in a book bound in limp purple leather.
"It is a collection of whimsical essays, The Prose Ramblings of a Rhymester, by Reginald Sprocket, a brilliant young poet from whom the critics expect great things. His style has been much praised, but it is the thought in these little gems to which I particularly call your attention. I will leave them here. I must be off. I only came to renew the book."
You probably think I reel beneath this blow, but actually my heart was not so heavy as it might have been, for my quick brain had perceived how this would do me a bit of good. The revolting object would make an admirable Christmas present for my Aunt Agatha, always a difficult person to find Yuletide gifts for. I was warming myself with this thought when Vanessa continued.
"Be careful not to lose it. It has Reginald's autograph in it."
And glancing at the title page, I saw that this was indeed so, which would have bucked Aunt Agatha up no little, but in addition to inscribing the slim volume with his own foul name, the blighter had inscribed Vanessa's. "To Vanessa, the fairest of the fair, from a devoted admirer." He'd written this, dishing my plans completely. That was when my heart got heavy again, for though she hadn't definitely said so, something told me that later on I'd be expected to pass an examination of the little opus, and failure would have the worst effects. Having said she must be off, she naturally stayed for another half an hour, much of which time was devoted to pointing out additional defects in my spiritual makeup, which had occurred to her since our last meeting. It just showed how strong the missionary spirit can be in women, that she could contemplate the idea of teaming up with a dubious character like B. Wooster. Her best friends would have warned her against it. "Cast him into the outer darkness, where there is weeping and gnashing of teeth," they would have said. "No good in trying to patch him up, he's hopeless." It was my membership of the Drones Club that now formed the basis of her observations. She didn't like the Drones Club, and she made it quite clear that at the conclusion of the honeymoon, I would cross its threshold only over her dead body. So, reckoning up the final score, the Bertram Wooster who signed the charge sheet at the vestry after the wedding ceremony would be a non-smoker, a teetotaler, for I knew it would come to that, and an ex-member of the Drones. In other words, a mere shell of his former self. Little wonder that as I listened to her, I gulped as Planck's native bear must have done when they were getting ready to bury him before sundown. The prospect appalled me, and while it was appalling me, Vanessa moved to the door, this time apparently really intending to be off. And she had opened the door, Bertram, much too much of a shell of his former self, to open it for her, when she started back with a gasping cry.
"Father!"
she cried gaspingly.
"He's coming up the garden path."
"He's coming up the garden path," I said. I was at loss to imagine why Pop Cook would be calling on me. I mean to say, we weren't on those terms.
"He stopped to tie his shoelace,"
she cried gaspingly as before, and that concluded her share of the dialogue. With no further words, she bounded into the kitchen like a fox pursued by both the corn and the pitchley, slamming the door behind her. I could appreciate her emotion. She was aware of her parents' distaste for the last of the Woosters, a distaste so marked that he turned mauve and swallowed his lunch the wrong way at the mention of my name. And shame me was the last place he would wish to find her. All her porter had thought the worst on learning of what he called her clandestine visits to the Wooster home, and a father, of course, would think worse than Orlo. Pure though I was as the driven S, fat chance I had of persuading him that I wasn't a modern Casa-something, not Casabianca. That was the chap who stood on the burning deck. Casanova. There, I knew I'd get it. And what would he do to Vanessa, and his wrath would be plenty. She was, as I have made clear, a proud beauty. Well, a father of the caliber of Pop Cook can make even a proud beauty wish she had thought twice before blotting her copybook. He may not be able any longer to wail the tar out of her with his walking stick, as in the good old days, but he can cut off her pocket money and send her to stay with her grandmother in Tunbridge Wells, where she will have to look after 7 cats and attend divine service 3 times on Sunday. Yes, one could understand her being perturbed on seeing him tying up his shoelace outside Wee Nook, which I forgot to mention earlier was the name of my GHQ. It had been built, I learned, subsequently, for a female cousin of Mrs. Briscoe's, who painted watercolors. And if Vanessa was perturbed, I was on the perturbed side, too. It was with some trepidation, in fact quite a lot of it, that I awaited my visitor's arrival, a trepidation that was not diminished when I saw that he had brought his hunting crop with him. I hadn't taken to him much at our previous meeting, and I had the feeling that I wasn't going to get very fond of him now. But I will say this for the man, that he didn't waste time. He was a man of quick, decisive speech, who had no use for tedious preliminaries, but came to the point at once. I suppose you have to in order to run a big business successfully.
Well, Wooster, as I understand you're calling yourself now, it may interest you to know that Major Plank, who had lost his memory, recovered it last night, and he told me all about you.
It was a nasty knock, and the fact that I had been expecting it didn't make it any better. Oddly enough, I felt no animosity toward Cook, holding Plank responsible for this awkward situation. Roaming through Africa, knee-deep in poisonous snakes of every description, and with more man-eating pumas around than you could shake a stick at, he could have so easily passed away, regretted by all. Instead of which, he survived and went about making life tough for harmless, typical young men about town, who simply wanted to be left alone to restore their delicate health. Cook was continuing, and getting nastier every moment.
You're a notorious crook, known to your associates as Alpine Joe, and your latest crime was to try to sell Major Plank a valuable statuette, which you'd stolen from Sir Watkin Bassett of Totley Towers. You were arrested by Inspector Witherspoon of Scotland Yard. Fortunately, before you would accomplish your nefarious ends, I presume from the fact that you are at large that you served your sentence, and you are now in the pay of Colonel Briscoe, who's implored you to steal my cat. Have you anything to say for yourself?
Yes, I said.
No, you haven't,
he said. I can explain everything, I said.
No, you can't,
he said. And by Jove, I suddenly realized I couldn't. It would have involved a long character analysis of Sir Watkin Bassett, another of my Uncle Tom, a third of Stephanie Stiffy Bing, now Mrs. Stinker Pinker, a fourth of Jeeves, and would have taken about 2.5 hours, provided he listened attentively and didn't interrupt, which of course he would have done. Matters, therefore, seemed to be at what you might call a deadlock, and the thought had suggested itself to me that my best plan would be to leave his presence and start running, and keep running, till I reached the northern fringe of Scotland. When a noise like an explosion in a gasworks broke in on my reverie, and I saw that he was holding the slim volume which Vanessa, the silly ass, had omitted to take off stage with her.
This book!
He yowled. I did my best. Ah, yes, I said. Reggie Sprockett's latest. I always keep up with his work. Brilliant young poet, of whom the critics expect great things. These, in case you're interested, are whimsical essays. They're superb, not only in style, but the thought in these little gems. My voice died away. I'd been about to urge him to buy a copy, but I saw he was not in the mood. He was staring at the opening page with the inscription, and I knew that words would be wasted, as the expression is. He gave the hunting crop a twitch.
My daughter has been here.
She did look in.
Ha!
I knew what that ha meant. It was short for, I shall now thrash you within an inch of your life. A moment later he used the longer version, as if in doubt as to whether he had made himself clear. If you had come in to me and say, Wooster, to settle a bet, would you prefer having your insides torn out by somebody's bare hands or being thrashed within an inch of your life? I would find it difficult to decide. Both are things you'd rather have happen to another chap. But I think I would give my vote in favor of the last named, always provided the other fellow was doing it in a small room, for there he would find that he had set himself a testing task. The dimensions of the sitting room of Wee Nook did not permit a full swing. Cook had to confine himself to chip shots, which an agile person like myself had little difficulty in eluding. I alluded then, therefore, with no great expenditure of physical effort. But I would be deceiving my public if I said that I was enjoying the episode. It offends one's pride that one has to leap like a lamb in springtime at the bidding of an elderly little God help us with whom it is impossible to reason. And it was plain that Cook, in his present frame of mind, wouldn't recognize reason if you served it up to him in an individual plate with watercress around it. That, of course, was what prevented me from fulfilling myself in the encounter. The fact that he was an elderly little God help us. It was the combination of age and size that kept me from giving up my best. I might, indeed I would have, dotted in the eye a small young God help us, or a God help us of riper years of the larger economy size. But I couldn't possibly get tough with an undersized little squirt who would never see 55 again. The chivalry of the Worcesters couldn't even contemplate such an action. I thought once or twice of adopting the policy which had occurred to me at the outset, viz., running up to the north of Scotland. I had often wondered when I read about fellows getting horsewhipped on the steps of their club, why they didn't just go up the steps into the club, knowing that the chap behind the horsewhip wasn't a member and wouldn't have a chance of getting past the hall porter. But the catch was, running up to Scotland would mean turning my back, and that was a fatal move. So we just carried on with our rhythmic dance till my guardian angel, who until now had just been sitting there, decided, and about time, too, to take a hand in the proceedings. As might have been expected in a cottage called Wee Nook, there was a grandfather clock against the wall, and he now arranged that Cook should bump into this and come a purler. And while he was still on the floor, I acted with the true Worcester resource. I have stated that the previous owner of Wee Nook expressed herself as a rule in watercolours, but on one occasion she had changed her act. Over the mantelpiece there hung a large oil painting, depicting a bloke in a three-cornered hat and riding breeches, in conference with a girl in a bonnet and what looked like a Muslim. And as it caught my eye, I suddenly remembered Gussie Finknottle and the portrait at Aunt Dahlia's place in Worcestershire. Gussie, stop me if you've heard this one before, while closely pursued by Spode, now Lord Sidcup, who, if memory serves me aright, wanted to break his neck, had taken refuge in my bedroom and was on the point of having his neck broken when he plucked a picture from the wall and brought it down on Spode's head. The head came through the canvas, and Spode momentarily bewildered at finding himself wearing a portrait of one of Uncle Tom's ancestors round his neck like an Elizabethan ruff, gave the opportunity of snatching a sheet from the bed, enveloping himself in it, and rendering him null and void, as the expression is. I went through a precisely similar routine now, first applying the picture, then a tablecloth, not having a bedsheet handy, after which I withdrew and went off to the Goose and Grasshopper to see Orlo.